Hi, I'm Laura.
And I'm Joe.
And this is Crime Divers.
Everybody, welcome to today's episode.
Hello everyone, welcome back.
Yep, thanks for joining us once again.
Yep, here we are for another Crime Divers episode. So Jill, where in the world are we?
We're in the USA.
And what is your title?
My Best Friend's Murder.
Okay.
So shall we just get on with it and just dive in?
Let's dive in.
Okay, so Angela Marie Samota, who went by Angie, was born on the 19th of September 1964 in Alameda, California. In 1982, Angie started university at the Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas, and she was going to study computer science and electrical engineering. So on her first day, she met a girl called Sheila Wysocki. So this is the best friend.
Right, they became best friends.
Yes, so they were going to be roommates. So, actually at first they didn't actually really get along because Angie had a boyfriend that Sheila didn't like. But then it didn't last long. So when they split up, Angie and Sheila actually became close and they became best friends.
Yeah.
She said that they both grew up without dads, and Sheila said that they bonded over not having fathers in their lives. They became best friends, and Sheila said Angie had a great personality and she was cute and she was smart. She would study late into the night and it paid off as she was doing well with her studies. But her second year of uni, Angie decided that she wanted to get an apartment off campus and she wanted to live by herself. So she moved out. But her and Sheila still remained best friends. And by that time, she'd met her boyfriend, Ben McCall. He was a little older than her and he worked in construction. So on the Friday the 12th of October 1984, when Angie was 20, she was going on a night out and there was like some big football game on between the University of Texas and the University of Oklahoma. So obviously that was going to be a really busy thing and all the pubs would be busy.
Yeah, the universities are quite big with their football and stuff. So
yeah, so it was a big deal. So it was going to, you know, like a lot of people would be out partying.
Yeah.
So Angie was going with her friend Anita Cadala. And she also invited her friend Russell Buchanan. He was 23 and he was an architect. So Angie had asked her boyfriend Ben if he wanted to join them, but he had said no, he was working the next game morning. He had to get up early, so he was like, nah, I'm just going to give it a miss.
He was being sensible.
Yeah. So Angie, Anita and Russell, they had a great night. They went on a bit of a bar crawl and they like danced the night away. And the last place that they were at was called the Rio Room. And they danced there, had a few drinks, and then they left at 1 a.m. But one of the employees said that Angie didn't seem to be intoxicated, which is good because she was the one who was actually driving. So,
well, you'd hope not then.
Yeah, so, but she's, you know, the other two had obviously been drinking, but she was just dancing and having fun. But obviously she was sober. So Angie dropped Russell off first at his apartment on Matilda Street, and then she dropped off Anita at her dorm. Anita was supposed to be spending the night at Angie's, but she changed her mind because Angie was planning on getting up early the next second day. So obviously, Anita was just like, I don't want to get up early and have to walk home or, you know, or drive home or whatever. You know, I'll just stay at my own house. Yeah. And so fair enough, I'd be the same.
Yeah, same.
So they'd left 1 o'clock. They'd left the pub and she dropped them off and then she went home. So at 1:30 in the morning, Ben, Angie's boyfriend, his phone started ringing. So he woke up and answered it, and it was Angie. And she just said, talk to me. And he said their conversation was odd, and she appeared to be nervous about something. Ben said he could hear something in the background, like somebody was there. So he was like, you know, is somebody in your apartment? Like, who's there? And she said it was a man. She had knocked on the door, and she had let him into the apartment when he'd asked to use the telephone in the bathroom.
Okay.
She then asked Ben if there was a payphone at the nearby shop, and there must have been a shop just down the road from her. And he was like, yeah, there is. So she'd said to the man, there's a phone down, you know, wherever it was, give him directions, said, you know, you can go and use that phone. And then she said to Ben, all right, I've got to go, I'll phone you back in a minute. So Ben waited a few minutes and she didn't call back.
Right.
So he was, you know, obviously starting to get a bit worried. Mm-hmm. And I think he tried phoning her and she hadn't answered the phone. So he then got, he got dressed and he got into his car. So although back in 1984, mobile phones, you know, obviously weren't a, like a thing, but he actually had a phone in his car.
Yeah, that was a thing, wasn't it?
We yeah. See, like, this one's like a big brick thing.
It was totally random, but I was I got in from work the other night and I like to wind down a bit. So I put the telly on and that, you know, Rain Man, Tom Cruise's film. And
I've never seen it.
But I've never seen it fully through, but I've always seen it parts. And it was like a scene where he was in his car and he had a phone in his car. Yeah. And I was like, oh, I forgot.
I don't think a lot, well, maybe in America people did, but I don't think a lot of people here had that. I know doctors did. And because when my best friend had an accident, it was like, luckily she'd been knocked over by a car. Mm-hmm. And luckily, one of our local doctors was passing, so it was him. He had the phone in his car, so he actually phoned the ambulance.
Ah, right,
because where she got knocked over, there was no houses or anything about, so that was really lucky for us. But
definitely.
I didn't know anybody personally who had a phone in their car.
No, I don't know any, but I just seen the film. I was like, oh, that's a thing back then, but yeah.
Well, anyway, Ben had a phone in his car, so he drove over to Angie's apartment, and he just kept phoning her while he was driving, but he was just getting no answer. So when he got there, he ran upstairs. She lived on the second floor. So he ran upstairs and knocked on the door, and he kept knocking and knocking, but there was no answer. So he ran back down to his car, and he tried phoning her again because he wanted to see if the phone was working, because he'd be able to hear it.
Because
he thought maybe the phone isn't working.
Uh-huh.
So he could actually hear the phone ringing, like, in the apartment. So he knew, right, there's nothing wrong with the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Why should I answer the door?
I've literally spoke to her not long ago.
So it was like, right, okay, I'm going to have to phone the police now. So he called the police and waited for them to arrive. So the police came and they gained entry. I don't know, they must have just kind of forced their way in.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing they saw was a single female shoe just lying on the living room floor.
Okay.
So they were like, right, okay, there's something not quite right here.
Mm-hmm.
So they split up to look around. And an officer found Angie lying dead on her bed.
Oh, God.
He described the scene in the bedroom as like evil preying on innocence. Angie was covered in blood. Her naked body was lying across the bed rather than like her head wasn't at the top of the bed and her feet at the bottom, you know, it's across the way. And both her legs were hanging off the side of the bed and her eyes were wide open. She had been brutally raped and she had been stabbed repeatedly. There were 18 stab wounds and her heart had practically been cut out by the stabbing and it was actually lying on top of her chest.
Oh, God. Oh, that sounds awful.
Yeah, I know. And beside her, there was a stuffed rabbit just put, like beside her, you know, like a toy, like a big stuffed rabbit next to her body. It just sounds so awful, doesn't it?
I know. I must admit, I've always had that fear, like I would hate my door to go at like a stupid time in the morning. I mean, I personally, I'm like, oh.
No, I know, but I think if the door went at that time in the morning, like I just think bad news, it's going to be the police.
And
something's happened to somebody or something like that. But, you know, that's unfortunately, it was obviously the man who should let in to the apartment.
I was going
to
say, I'm assuming it was him and it must have been happened like instantly as soon as she got off the phone.
Well, yeah, it must have. Sheila, Angie's best friend. No, I'm sorry, I've just missed a bit. So, rewind. So the police's initial thoughts were right. Okay, this wasn't a break-in. It wasn't some random stranger. This is someone who Angie knew that she let into the apartment.
Mm.
And with Angie being stabbed 18 times, it was like, it was somebody who was angry at her.
Yeah.
You know, there was a reason for this, like why they'd done this.
Because I mean, you know, I don't know if, you know, like say if the door goes at 10 in the morning and it's not somebody you know, you would be a bit wary about letting them into your apartment, wouldn't you? So maybe she obviously did know him.
Well, that's what they thought, yeah. And like I said, because it just seemed like when somebody kills somebody, if it's that brutal, it's usually like a personal thing.
Yeah, because
like,
they're like really angry and they just do it over and over and over
again. Yeah. So the police and her friends and everybody, they all thought, right, it's somebody that Angie knew. And Sheila, our best friend, she was actually sure that it was Angie's ex-boyfriend, the one that she hadn't liked.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the summer before that, and when Angie was with this guy, she had called Sheila one night and told her that the guy had pulled a knife on her. And so they phoned the police.
Right.
And there had been an occasion where he had cut up her clothes in a rage as well.
Oh,
so
God.
Never seen why Sheila didn't like him.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she always had very, very good reasons just to not like him.
So that's why she thought
it could
was
it be him.
Him?
Mm-hmm.
But as the police investigated him, they found he had an alibi. He was working the night of the murder. And the swabs of semen and saliva they took from him proved that it couldn't have been him. And I'm gonna like sort of get onto that in a minute. There's a reason for that. I'll get onto that in a minute, right?
Yeah, okay.
So the other two suspects, so that's three suspects. So there was the ex-boyfriend.
Uh-huh.
And the other ones were Angie's boyfriend, Ben, because he's the boyfriend.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Russell, because he'd been out with her.
Yeah, he'd been out with him, yeah. Uh-huh.
So Ben was a suspect because he'd been the one to call the police, mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah.
And the police perceived him as indifferent, and that made them very suspicious. They felt that the 911 call wasn't very panicky. Yeah, I know.
I mean, how many times? I mean, I don't think anybody knows how they're going to react in a situation like that. And some people might be really panicky in their voice. Some people might be able to be calm in their voice.
It could be shock.
Oh, yeah, it could be shock. Yeah. They've, you know, anything. It could. That doesn't mean that makes them suspicious because of the way they've made the phone call.
I mean, in some cases it probably does. But maybe it does, but, you know.
Not every case is like that. I mean, I don't know how I would react in that
exactly.
situation. I mean, I might
Nobody knows how they're going to react.
Mm-hmm.
And at the crime scene as well, like, it just didn't seem to show any emotion. But, I mean, it could be shock.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean,
disbelief, you know.
Yeah, could be anything.
And then police thought that because Angie had gone out with Russell that night, that Ben got jealous and went over to her apartment in a fit of rage and killed her. So mm-hmm. that was their kind of reason, mm-hmm. yeah. So Ben was questioned and he gave them a blood sample and a saliva sample. So I'll explain about the blood, semen and saliva samples.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to giving these samples, because remember, obviously, we're back in 1984?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's not as what it
advanced
is
as it is now. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to giving these samples, there are people who are secretors.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who are non-secretors. So a secretor, so I just find that quite a weird word to say. It's a person who secretes blood type antigens into their body fluids, like saliva and semen. So like by that, you would find out their body type.
Right.
Body type? Blood type, sorry.
Blood type, yeah.
By their liquids.
their bodily fluids.
Yeah. So a non-secretor is a person who doesn't secrete the blood type antigens into their body fluids so that you can't tell what their blood type is by mm-hmm. looking at their body fluids.
Right, okay.
So do you understand?
I'm assuming that's just like a natural bodily thing that happens, that some people's bodies...
Some do and some don't.
Some don't, yeah.
Did you understand?
Yeah, I get what you mean, yeah.
Okay. So basically it means that a non-secretor's blood type can't be found in any of their fluids.
Mm-hmm.
But there's only 15 to 20% of the population are non-secretors. So if you get the population 15 to 20%, that's not a lot.
Not a lot, no.
Right. So Ben and Angie's ex-boyfriend were soon ruled out because they were both secretors.
Mm-hmm.
So that left Russell Buchanan as the primary suspect. He was the last known male to have seen Angie as they had been out together, and he only lived 5 minutes away. So police suspected that sometime after Angie dropped him off, he just walked back to her apartment, knocked on the door, and maybe tried on with her. And when she refused to have sex with him, he's raped and killed her.
So then my question, I don't know if you're going to answer it or not, is when she phoned Ben, why would she not have said it was him there?
I don't know.
Because she said that there's been a man that's asked to use the toilet in the phone.
Yeah, but you have to remember that that's only Ben's account of what she said.
Yeah,
how do we not know that Ben's the killer?
This is true. We don't know that at this point.
Yeah. So Angie's friends had been asked to get in contact with the police so they could be interviewed. So Sheila, the best friend, made an appointment, and she went down to the police station. She said that she went into the room, sat down at the desk, and was shown photos of Angie's body without warning.
Oh, God.
She was shown photos at the crime scene and also autopsy photos.
Really?
Mm-hmm. She said, I just felt paralysed. She said she saw her best friend covered in blood with her eyes open, lying dead on her bed.
No, that's an image you probably never forget.
Yeah, exactly. Why would they show them that? Absolutely awful.
I mean, they could maybe say, look, we would like to show you.
But why would they want to show her?
I don't know what that would help her.
I don't know. Yeah, exactly. I don't know what that would achieve.
What are they trying to sort of maybe get her to be saying to them if they're show? Because, I mean, normally when they show pictures of evidence, it's to jog someone's memory, or I wouldn't have thought that they would...
I just don't understand that in the slightest. I don't think there's any need for her to see those, and she will never get... She's going to remember her best friend like that forever.
Mm, yeah, that's quite horrific.
It is. It's awful.
Especially with no warning as well. I mean,
you would think they'd say, right, we're going to show you pictures, or is it okay if we show you these pictures? Yeah. I would have said no.
No, I'd be like, no, thank you. Don't.
You can describe it to me. Mm. Not that I really want to know that, but, you know, obviously I have to, but I don't want to see pictures.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the police told her that Russell had murdered Angie and then he had left town. So to police, it looked like he'd gone into hiding, but he actually 2 days later, he came back.
Right.
He said that he'd been at a wedding in Houston, and they did verify that the morning after Angie's murder, he had caught a flight to Houston and attended a wedding.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like prearranged. It wasn't like he's killed somebody and
just
ran off.
Off.
Yeah, uh-huh. This was a prearranged
trip. He was already going away.
Mm-hmm. So he hadn't been in hiding,
mm-hmm.
But they still strongly suspected him. So when he got back, there was a knock at his door and he answered it to police with their guns drawn, shouting, "Are you Russell Buchanan?"
Mm-hmm.
So he was taken to the police station where he gave them a statement denying any involvement. He was like, "No, it wasn't me."
Mm-hmm.
And he gave blood and a saliva sample and it was discovered that Russell was a non-secretor.
Mm-hmm.
So considering only 15 to 20% of the population are non-secretors, he was the last known male
uh-huh.
to see Angie. He only lived 5 minutes away.
It didn't look good.
It wasn't look good.
No.
It wasn't looking good for him and he couldn't be ruled out as a suspect.
Mm-hmm.
So Sheila, she was having meetings with the lead detective, Detective Sparks, on, you know, the lead detective on the case.
Uh-huh.
And she said herself, she's a nosy person.
Mm-hmm.
She knows, she knew Angie's retained, she knew Ben, she knew Russell. So she was having meetings with the detective because she could, like, sort of give a lot of insight on their lives.
Yeah.
You know. So the detective told her that they didn't believe Russell when he said that he had nothing to do with it. That, you know, that he was...
They thought he was...
They were like, yeah, this is the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And she had, and she said, like, when they told her it was Russell, she had, like, knots in her stomach. And she told them that. She said to the detective that she had knots in her stomach. And he was like, oh, that's your intuition.
Mm-hmm.
That's telling you that Russell's the murderer.
Mm-hmm.
So Detective Sparks asked Sheila to invite Russell out to dinner.
Okay.
I'm assuming because we're friends and he's hoping that Russell might slip up
or
something.
Like, might reveal something.
Yeah. So obviously she was, like, really wary. And she said to the detective, like, is this guy going to end up, like, pulling a knife on me
mm-hmm.
and stabbing me, like, the way that, you know, it's happened to my best friend?
It seems crazy that they would put her in a situation with one of their suspects that they would, you know, want her to sort of, you know... I mean, I'm hoping that they would have had some eyes on her that...
Well, I would assume so.
But still.
She's probably wired and stuff, I would think. But the detective said, no, it was probably a one-time killing and you're going to be in a public area. Don't worry about it.
Right,
like, it's all right for you, see?
I know, exactly.
Yeah, you're not the one that's putting yourself in danger.
Well, exactly. I still wouldn't be that comfortable doing that, if I'm honest. Because I don't think I'd be able to act natural either. Because you would just be so wary. And especially if the police have asked you, you'd have that in the back of your mind.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
I just don't think it would be a natural thing for me. I'd be, like, really uncomfortable. And
the guy would probably be like, what the hell is wrong with you?
Yeah,
like,
and especially if... I mean, I don't know, obviously... their background, but is it something they've done before? Have they been out for dinner before?
I don't know. I know they knew each other.
Yeah, because if it was just like an out of the blue, oh, let's go for dinner, the guy might be thinking, well, this is not something we normally do, so why all of a sudden are we doing this?
Well, that's why I'm kind of thinking maybe it was something that they would do, because it would seem a bit out of the ordinary just to invite them out for dinner if they didn't really know each other that well.
Exactly. But I know we can't know every detail about their...
No. So one night Russell picked up Sheila from her house and they went to a Chinese restaurant for dinner. They were just chatting about normal stuff and catching up and nothing eventful happened. Because I think they must have told her not to actually mention it. It was just to see sort of if anything would come up. But then you'd think that that's what you would talk about.
Well, no, because I was just going to say, because if that had happened...
Or maybe they did.
I mean, my best friend, I'd be thinking that's the only thing I'd be able to think about at that moment. I mean, it just would seem like something you couldn't help but talk about.
Well, maybe they did, but just the way that it kind of came about, it was just like they were just catching up and stuff. So.
Yeah, which I don't know how you could be that normal.
Maybe it wasn't. Maybe I think at the end, it doesn't matter anyway. Whatever they were talking about, nothing happened. He didn't slip up. He didn't see anything. Nothing eventful happened.
Mm-hmm.
When Russell was driving her home, she said that she looked over at him and was thinking it just wasn't making sense to her that this man murdered her best friend. She just couldn't quite believe it.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, the police kept Russell under surveillance. They would follow him to work, they would and then they would go into his work and pick him up and take him to the station to interrogate him. And they would show him.
So they obviously didn't have any concrete evidence at this point then. They were just like...
I think the main thing was the non-secretor because it's such a rare thing that I think that, and the fact...
that he'd been last
to
see
her.
Yeah,
but, you know, it can be... Well, it might be, might not be, might be coincidence.
Well, sometimes it is coincidence.
So they would follow him to work, pick him up for work, and then just go, right, come on, we're going to the police station.
They just, like, try to intimidate him as well, I think.
Probably, yeah. And they would show him, like, the crime scene photos as well, like, just shoving them right in his face and everything, which I can understand more, because if a suspect was saying, this is what you've done to this person, they might kind of crack and maybe confess. So I can understand
that. To me, that's what they're looking for him to do here, is that they've not got any concrete evidence apart from the non-secretion thing. Mm-hmm. Then they're obviously trying to get him to confess to it and try to just intimidate him at this point.
And, like, Russell said... So, like, they were showing the crime scene photos and say, we know what you did, you know. And then Russell said that he would be at, a stoplight in his car, and Detective Sparks would just pull up next to him, like, just to let him know that he was still following him. Mm-hmm. So that, to me, that's intimidation, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. So that's almost, like, harassing him. I mean...
They might have a good reason, though.
Well, I mean, I just don't know if that, you know, when you've got a suspect, I mean, surely there's, like, limits of what you can...
Well, I don't know, because that's... He can't prove that he's been followed just because, it's a coincidence that the detective pulled up next to me, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He had previously passed a polygraph, but then police were now saying it was inconclusive. So they've obviously decided, they've made up their minds.
But yeah, if they had failed it, that would have been absolutely correct, of course. Do you know what I mean?
They're just making up their own narrative, really, aren't they? They're just like, they're fitting it.
Yeah, basically, they decided this is the guy, they've got one little bit that obviously they think's that's enough to sort of tie into it, but we obviously need more to make it like a real good case. So now we're just gonna align things so that they all fit,
so everyone fits
to our narrative of what's happened.
Yeah, that's basically what it is. So Russell, up to this point, Russell hadn't had an attorney, but now his parents have told him to get one.
Mm-hmm.
And in Sheila's words, quote, he lawyered up, and you know, most guilty people lawyer up. And then I was told that they couldn't touch him anymore. So with all that evidence stacking up, it was Russell, end quote. So Mina now, she believed that Russell was guilty. She was like, it was him.
Yeah, because I mean, I can kind of see, but I'm doubting whether it is Russell at the moment. It just seems too easy to be him right now.
Well, I'm not saying a word. So a few months later, Russell left the country. And to Sheila, that was more proof that he did it, because it looked like he was fleeing. But he had actually been accepted to grad school in London, which he had obviously previously applied for before all this.
And I'm assuming he was allowed to leave the country even though he was under investigation.
Yeah, so the police couldn't stop him because he hadn't been charged with anything, so they couldn't stop him. But they still believed that he was guilty. And the detective even said to Sheila that, he said, our suspect's gone, so we're going to have to close the case.
Oh.
So that's how much they believed that it was him.
Mm-hmm.
So it was about 9 or 10 months after Angie's murder when the police had to suspend the investigation. They said that they knew Russell was the murderer, but there just wasn't enough physical evidence to charge him.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Sheila said that after Angie died, her whole world changed. Her safe world, that she was no longer safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were bad people out there, really evil people that would rape someone on top of that brutally murder someone. And she couldn't stop thinking about what a horrible way it was that, you know, that Angie died. And obviously, she's seen these pictures as well. She's not only got a description of how her friend died, she's seen the pictures.
Yeah, that would have definitely affected her mentally.
Definitely. I mean, so she ended up, like, she didn't finish college. She just walked away from it. She didn't even, like, withdraw. She just, one day, just up and left.
Right.
That's me, I'm done. Yeah. She got married in 1988, moved to Tennessee and had two children. And her life just went on. I had to, you know, she just had to get on with it.
Absolutely.
So 20 years later, in 2004.
Oh, wow.
Sheila was taking a Bible study class and she was in her house doing homework. Her entire house was quiet, like her husband and kids weren't there at the time. So it was just like rare that the house was dead quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And she just kind of looked up and saw a vision. And she said it was Angie. She could see Angie.
All right.
And it was a vision of Angie the first time that she ever saw her. Remember, they met on the first day, first day of university. And she was smiling at her and she said it was just exactly the way that she remembered her.
Mm-hmm.
And she said it only lasted for a couple of seconds. There was no talking or anything, just Angie just smiling at her. And Sheila said she put her pen down and thought, it's time. I need to make a phone call. Angie's telling me it's time. I need to find her killer.
Oh, wow. Right. So I just got goosebumps there.
So Sheila started calling the Dallas police. I've got goosebumps as well, actually.
I know.
I'm not sure if I was just cold.
I don't know when I was crying, but I can just feel like all the goosebumps on my body.
Yeah. But, I mean, you're going to be saying good on Sheila. So she started calling the Dallas police. Mm-hmm. She started with the original investigator, Detective Sparks. Mm-hmm. She left a message, but he didn't call back. So she tried again and again. After leaving 50 messages, he still hadn't called back.
That's a bit rude, isn't it?
Well, that's what I thought. I thought, seriously, how hard is it just for a quick phone call?
Well, exactly. I can understand the first couple of times being busy, but surely you would...
50 times. That's just being ignorant.
Totally.
So she started making calls to the homicide division, and they told her that nobody had called about Angie's case in 20 years, and it was like she'd been forgotten about.
Hmm.
You know, they'd always, as I said, like, they obviously thought, well, Russell's done it. We can't prove it. We can't charge him.
Yeah.
And it's just been left. Nobody's even, like, re-looked into it. Nobody's phoned up to say, is there anything happening?
Like, yeah. It's just been, like,
yeah,
that's it. It's just forgotten about.
So Sheila said that even she knew from just watching TV that there would be a file. There would be, like, evidence. So why not get that back out and, like, just get somebody to have another look at it.
Especially 20 years later. I mean, technology's moved on as well. It's already advanced. I mean, how many times do you hear about these cold cases that have happened, and then because of new technologies and stuff that we have now, they've been able to solve them. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely worth looking back up.
Yep. So she was determined to get the case open again and to get Angie's killer prosecuted. So she said back in 1984, they had made a determination it was Russell Buchanan who had murdered Angie, and he was still the prime suspect.
Mm-hmm.
And now it was 20 years later, as you've just said, Sheila knew there was a massive advancement
mm-hmm.
When it came to testing DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So she was, like, speaking to different detectives, different departments. She just kept calling and calling. She was determined that someone was going to pay attention to her. She was just not giving up.
Yeah.
And she made over 700 calls.
Oh, wow.
It's ridiculous.
Good on her.
But it's ridiculous that she's had to make that many calls.
Well, I know.
And because she was just... you know, just a private citizen, a normal person. Mm. Like, she wasn't a police officer. She was, you know, none like that.
Yeah.
She was just a mum from Tennessee. She was just being brushed off and just disregarded. She was told the evidence had been lost in a flood. They kept telling her that she couldn't find, that they couldn't find the evidence, but she's just like, no, like, she just didn't believe them.
Yeah, they're just trying to fob it off, basically.
And at the time, the Dallas Police Department didn't have a cold case squad.
Right.
They just didn't have the funding for it. So they had homicide detectives who were handling murder cases of the present, and that number was in the hundreds. Mm. So
they were very, very busy.
Yeah, so murders from the past wasn't a top priority for them.
Mm-hmm.
So you can understand.
Yeah, I get that.
But still need to be rude. You can still phone people back.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Just take her seriously. Just take on board what she's saying to you.
Well, Sheila, you know, as you kind of realise, Sheila is a very determined person.
Yeah.
And she wasn't going to be put off. So she still just kept calling and calling. And one day she spoke to a rookie, you know, a new uh-huh. recruit.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that person didn't know about the case.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't know that Sheila had already called, like, hundreds of times before.
Yeah.
And this rookie actually gave her the time of day.
Well, so, he probably wants to make a good impression and wants, you know, he's new to the police force and probably wants to do his job.
Yeah.
Like, as well as they can, so, yeah.
So Sheila said to them, like, you know, surely you must have records of what was lost in the floods.
Uh-huh.
And Sheila said, I'm coming to Dallas soon, how about I go through the basement with you? And the rookie said, well, I don't know if that evidence is actually lost. And it turned out it wasn't.
The police were just not wanting to look into it and fobbing it off.
There was evidence, and they could get a hold of it. Well done to this rookie.
Yeah. But see, that's sometimes why it's good to get these rookies in, because they obviously, like I say, they're new blood into the police force. They mm-hmm. want to make a good impression. They want to do everything by the book. You know, they'll not brush anything off. Whereas if it's a police officer that's been in the force 20, 30 years, they're probably like, nah, I can't be bothered now. So I'm not dealing with it. Whatever.
Yeah, but because, you know, obviously they were new, they said to Sheila they would have to speak to their sergeant and call her back. But, of course, the sergeant must have been like, no.
Nope.
Never got a call back.
Oh.
But at least she'd got the information that she knew that there was evidence there. So she did get something out of that phone call.
Uh-huh.
So she now lived in a gated community with security. And one day she was chatting with the head of security, and she's obviously telling him about what happened about the case. And she was saying... that she, you know, she really wanted to get solved.
Yeah.
And she asked him if he had any ideas on what he could do. And he said, well, because so far how she'd been going, like, dealing with it and, like, phoning everybody and trying to get all this information, he's like, you know what, you'd be really good as a private investigator. Mm. Private investigator.
Yeah.
So that's what she did. She did whatever you have to do. I don't know what you have to do to be a... I think you take exams and stuff. Right, okay. But she did whatever you have to do to get your licence, and she became a private investigator. Hmm. I mean, I told you she was determined.
Yeah, you did.
So, because she was a private investigator, you have access to records that you wouldn't normally have, which is what I meant by earlier on. She was just a normal person. She was a private citizen that can get a hold of certain records, but as a private investigator, you can.
She can, right.
So Sheila said that when she got her licence and called the Dallas police, she thought they would open everything up to her. She thought they would say, here's all the evidence, go and solve it.
Uh-huh.
But they didn't.
No. Well, it's easy
I
as
think
that.
We know enough about this police department anyway to know that wasn't going to happen.
No, definitely not.
All it did was tell them... So basically, her having her PI licence, all it did was tell them that she wasn't going away, because she's like, look, I've got the licence there, I ain't going anywhere.
I'm wanting to get this information. Yeah.
So she continued to call the police department. I hate to think what her phone bill must have been
I
like.
I mean, the thing is, right, surely they must think, for God's sake, will we just deal with it? Just to stop her, like, phoning all the time, because they must have been getting irritated with it. But then to me, it's like, well... You can clearly see now she's not going to stop calling you, so isn't it just best you like give her the time of day and actually look into it for her, and then, you know, she'll stop, hopefully, or at least, you know, get what she needs and whatever.
Well, that wasn't the case. Like, that makes sense, but...
Mm-hmm.
So she continued to call the police department, trying to get them to open the case or talk about the case, and, like, you know, we're talking about hundreds of calls again.
She's obviously very determined.
Yes. And good on her.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm hoping we're going to get the answers, so I'm hoping that our determination has paid off, or will pay off.
Yeah. So, Sheila still believed that Russell was the murderer, so as she had her PI licence, she decided to see what he was doing now, like where he was, like had he murdered anybody else, had he committed any other crimes, but he came up completely clean.
Right, okay.
One of the things that Sheila started in... 2005, so the following year, obviously, because she's got her PI license now, mm-hmm. She decided to start tracing all the assaults and unsolved murders in the area.
Right.
So she got a map, and she mapped out all the unsolved murders that had happened, obviously, in a particular...
area?
Well, I wasn't going to say area again. I was going to say... Well, it's not going to be everywhere, is it? It's like within a certain amount of...
Radius?
Yeah, that thing. And, like, So she got a map and mapped out all the unsolved murders that happened and how many assaults there were in that area and how many assaults were rape as well, mm-hmm. you know. And she tried to come up with a pattern. She even had a room in her house dedicated to her investigation, which was referred to as the war room.
Ooh.
And I'm picturing it, like, on TV when there's an investigation in a room in a police station and you've got all the photos up on the wall and the red bits of string pointing
to. Yeah.
That's what I'm picturing.
Yeah.
I think that's what she had.
Sounds like it.
So eventually the Dallas police dedicated two detectives and called them the cold case unit.
Oh my god.
We got a cold case unit. But they were going to have to start working on hundreds of cases.
I was going to say, because it wouldn't just be that case, yeah.
So one of the detectives was called Linda Crum, and she knew that Sheila had been calling and calling and calling and calling.
Mm-hmm.
So she started that actually caused her to go to Angie's case first.
Uh-huh.
So if she hadn't been phoning, Angie could have been away doing the list.
Yeah.
So it was because she knew... that this woman had been phoning.
Let's start here.
Yeah. I mean, who knows how long it would have taken to get to it.
Mm.
So thank God for Linda Crum.
Mm-hmm.
So one day Sheila received a call from Linda Crum, and she said she had the file and she was looking over the case. So you can imagine how happy Sheila must have been.
I mean, Sheila, sorry, would have been happy about the fact that Angie was coming back to the forefront and being not forgotten about anymore.
And she said, Sheila said that she loved Linda. She said she was smart, she was detailed, she was very thorough. And of course, like, she could get to the evidence that Sheila hadn't been able to get to.
Absolutely.
So straight away, Linda phoned the crime lab, hoping that there would be some DNA evidence that might potentially be tested. She wasn't very hopeful because, obviously, you know, this is 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Now. Mm-hmm. But luckily, they said, yes, we do have some physical evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So they had preserved the swabs and the smears from the rape kit from 24 years before.
Right.
So it was all sent off for testing. And meanwhile, Sheila was still calling people and trying to keep up with Russell. Because she's like, we're going to get him now because we're going to get the DNA Tess back and we're going to get him, we're going to nail him.
Yeah.
So she'd found out that Russell was living a good life. He was an architect. I think they earned quite good money. Like, yeah. He was quite well, he was well respected. And Sheila said she just couldn't understand it because he was a murderer. Like, how has he gotten away with it? And how is he living such a good life?
Yeah, yeah.
So in April 2008, so that was 24 years after Angie's murder, Sheila got a phone call from Linda Crubb. And Linda just said, "We got him."
Mm-hmm.
So now, when she said we got him, her next words that Sheila expected her to say was Russell Buchanan.
Uh-huh.
But they weren't.
No,
you're right.
It wasn't him. But I was actually thinking, oh, maybe it is him. No, but it's not him.
She told Sheila that it was a serial rapist called Donald Bess.
Oh.
And Sheila was shocked. She had never heard of this guy. Everybody and the whole investigation and family, friends, everybody was so sure it was going to be somebody that mm-hmm. they knew.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't.
So going back to the whole thing about when Angie phoned Ben and said there's a strange guy, like a random guy, mm-hmm. It obviously was a random guy.
So, but I just think, I don't know why that wasn't sort of taken into consideration.
Well, yeah, because that's what I'm saying. Like, if it had been Russell, then I thought that
she would have said Russell's here.
Russell's here, yeah.
But
why would she have needed to phone Ben, you know? So, yeah, so to me, that would have been, like, a bit of a doubt at that moment.
Yeah,
so I don't understand why that wasn't really...
That was running through my head the whole time.
Especially once they ruled Ben out of being a suspect, because obviously, like you say, he could have just made that up at that moment. But once they ruled it out and he wasn't a suspect anymore, then what he said to me was quite important, because he didn't say that Angie said it was someone she knew.
Well, exactly. He was the last person that she spoke to. So why are they not... Unless they've thought he's made a mistake, maybe she didn't say that, or maybe he's kind of said, "Well, actually, maybe she didn't say that." Like, you know,
maybe. But
I mean, how hard is it to sometimes to remember things, like especially when something traumatic's happening?
Yeah,
you know,
I guess so. But
I don't know. But anyway, it was a strange man.
Mm-hmm.
This guy's name had never came up in the 24 years since Angie's murder. This guy's name, he'd never been a suspect. He'd not even been a person of interest. Like, just absolutely nothing. So Sheila obviously immediately went online and looked him up. So Donald Bess was a convicted rapist on parole when he murdered Angie. And it was just a random act. He didn't know Angie and he was 36 at the time. I don't know if he followed her home or something. Because, like, to knock on somebody's door and it just happened to be a single
young girl
seems a bit... So I'm thinking maybe he's seen her getting out of the car and maybe followed her up to her apartment.
He was just looking for an opportunity, possibly.
Yeah, I think so. So at this time... So now, when they realise it's him, and he's in prison now at this point.
Right, okay.
So he was currently in prison on a life sentence for aggravated sexual assault that he had committed 7 months after Angie's death.
Right.
And he was just about to be paroled again.
Right.
So, luckily they caught him before he got paroled again and then it did it to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
But then, so the night of Angie's murder, she had gone home after dropping her friends off, and about 10 minutes later, there'd been a knock at the door. She'd opened it, and this guy, Donald Bess, who was 265 pounds, which is about 18 and a half stone,
mm-hmm.
and 6'3" was standing there. Because you can imagine, this was a big guy.
Mm.
He just stepped right into her house. He then asked for a drink of water and to use the phone. He went down the hallway and she went in the opposite direction to where the phone was, and she called Ben. So while she was on the phone to Ben, Donald Bess had walked around to make sure that she was alone, and he had picked up a knife. She had hung up the phone and basically just grabbed her, dragged her into the bedroom and raped her. He covered her mouth and he started stabbing her. When he was finished, he went into the bathroom and washed his hands, took a towel and the knife, and just left the apartment, just walked away from it.
Wow.
So, while being interviewed by police, Donald Bess stated that all women are bitches.
Lovely.
Thanks for that.
Mm-hmm.
But when this was testified in court, Sheila was there, she said that she was sitting there with her notepad and she wrote down, "Well, this bitch just put you in that chair."
I like that.
Yes, Sheila.
Yeah, go Sheila. That was actually really good. I like that.
So I thought that was... I just thought, God, see Sheila, what a woman.
Oh, yeah, totally.
So on the Monday, the 14th of June, 2010, Donald Bess was sentenced to death. He has since appealed a few times, but the appeals have been rejected. So he's now 74 and still on death row with no execution date set. So Russell Buchanan got a phone call from the Dallas Police Department.
Uh-huh.
And they told him that Angie's murderer had been caught and they apologised to him.
Mm-hmm.
But he was actually unaware that he was considered a prime suspect. Like, obviously, he knew back
then.
But as I said, like, he just went on with his life, and because he'd went away to London and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
I think he just thought, oh, well, because they weren't harassing him anymore or anything like that. Because look what they'd been doing to him, following mm-hmm. him and interrogating him.
That was it.
They must thought they've moved on to somebody else, like that, you know. So he didn't even know all these years, which is probably a good thing.
I'm just going to say, I'm kind of glad for him, because that would have been horrible, maybe, like. If he still thought that, and he was maybe always looking over his shoulder. So maybe it was a good thing he actually went to London, and that sort of enabled him to get on with his life, and he was unaware of what people still thought about him and stuff. And
I think so. And, like, you know, imagine, like, for 24 years, just looking over your shoulder, wondering if the police are going to come and get you. Which, technically, the police might have still come and got him, but... Yeah.
Is this the day that they're going to come and arrest me and charge me and convict me for a crime that I clearly didn't commit? Which I'm so glad that he didn't get to that. That didn't happen to him, mm-hmm. because, I mean, there has been cases where people... have been wrongly convicted mm-hmm. of crimes, which they could have easily done that, I guess. Mm-hmm. I mean, thankfully.
I mean, they could have still took it to court and just hoped that the jury would have convicted them on what they had.
Yeah.
But that would have been a bit flimsy.
Yeah. But they obviously didn't have enough evidence to get to that point, which is really good.
Which is good. Well, they didn't, because they didn't do it.
Well, yeah, exactly. He didn't do it, exactly. But.
Yeah, so thank God. I think it's good that he didn't know. And Sheila met up with him, and she asked for his forgiveness because she felt so guilty that all these years she thought it was him.
Mm-hmm.
But he had said, like, you know, she didn't need to ask for forgiveness. Like, if it wasn't for her, the case would still never have been solved.
Mm-hmm.
And she stopped that monster from being back out on the streets.
Yeah,
so,
totally. And they got the right person, which is important.
That's what I'm saying. Like, if it hadn't been for her, that case would have still been unsolved and he would have got out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
And probably done it. I mean, like, because he murdered Angie when he was on parole.
Yeah. So he had form for doing that.
Yeah, if he got out again, he probably would have done it to somebody else.
Yeah.
So after the trial, Sheila retired her PI licence. So she only got it just to do that. But when her story got out, people were writing to her about their own unsolved cases.
Right.
So she reinstated her licence, and she's ever since she's been helping other people solve their cases.
Oh, wow.
So she's, what a woman.
Mm, totally.
What an absolute legend.
I know.
Yeah. And at least I know it took, you know, a long time, but at least... You've finally got the right person.
Yeah, exactly, because it doesn't obviously change what's happened. It doesn't bring Angie back and stuff, but at least, you know, they got the justice for her and got the man that did it.
Yeah.
And I suppose in some ways, maybe at least we know that this man hadn't lived a good life in some way, because he was obviously in prison for doing it. I mean, obviously, a shame that somebody else has had to be attacked for him to be in prison, but at least he wasn't roaming the streets free all this time.
Yeah. He hadn't got away with it and was roaming the streets. Yeah. You know, 7 months, I mean, he maybe did attack other people. Mm. Well, we know he at least attacked one person. There might have been others in the 7 months. But, I mean, it could have been a lot worse for those 24 years. He could have been out doing it.
Exactly.
Know.
Or just living a great life and getting away with it.
Yeah, exactly. So at least he was in prison. Mm-hmm. But, just what a monster.
Totally.
And I'm so glad that Russell, eventually, I mean, like, even though he wasn't aware he was a prime suspect,
mm-hmm.
but he was. Mm-hmm. And people were obviously thinking, all these people all these years were still thinking that he was a murderer.
Well, exactly.
So I'm glad that, you know, they know that he's done nothing wrong.
Thank
you, everybody, for listening. Mm-hmm. If you would like to get in contact with us, we're on Instagram and Twitter, and that's crime_divers_pod.
Mm-hmm.
Our email is crime_divers_pod@outlook.com. Our YouTube is Crime Divers Podcast. Our TikTok is Crime Divers Podcast. That's all one word. Our Patreon is patreon.com/crimedivers, where you get bonus content, early access, no ads, all that kind of stuff. If you want to buy us a coffee, buyusacoffee.com/crimedivers. And
if you haven't already, please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.